This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by a brilliant physician leader. We're joined today by Dr. John Hunter. And John's had this fascinating career. He currently serves as the CEO of OHSU, which I think the full name is the Oregon Health Sciences University. He's been the dean. He's had a brilliant career, chief of surgery, esophageal cancer and esophageal treatments and GI. Dr. Hunter, you'll do a better job of explaining your background than I will, but what a fantastic career. Can you take a moment and tell us a bit about yourself and a little bit about OHSU?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Becker. Really a pleasure to be with you today. I have really enjoyed my career as a academic surgeon and health care administrator. Really starting as a chair of surgery for 15 years at OHSU in 2001, serving as the interim dean of the School of Medicine for a year, and then migrating into health system management as we created a health system out of a practice plan out of several community hospitals, and really strove towards alignment and integration of healthcare services in this academic environment. The OHSU Health is a system that includes our OHSU Hospital, OHSU Dornbecker Children's Hospital, a faculty practice plan, Adventist Health Portland, Hillsborough Medical Center. And then we also have dozens of patient care locations, health services, clinics throughout the Portland metro area. Our goal in all this is to serve as many Oregonians as possible with outstanding patient care, informed by innovative research and education. That's what we call that special sauce of academic medicine.
And talk to us a little bit about your career, how you transitioned into leadership. Just give us some of the deeper background yourself, if you don't mind.
Not at all. I was thinking about this the other day that really after 4 years out of my residency, I became at Emory, the chief of GI and general surgery. So I've been in academic surgical leadership in essentially all my career, starting in 1992. But I think the big transition really was that from, a faculty member to a health system leader. I think I had the great pleasure of working with some remarkable people. Joe Robertson, the president of OHSU, was a ophthalmologist faculty leader, and really helped me understand the nuances as well as the specifics of management of a complex academic health system. I think coming from the provider side, I was really the first CEO at OHSU who maintained and still maintains an active practice. And that has really, I think, given me sort of a lens into how things work, as well as the credibility from the faculty and staff, that their CEO is actually on the front line with them on a daily basis.
Besides Joe, Dr. Robertson, what have been influences to you as you think about leadership management, as you've thought about, obviously it's been a long-term transition now, but as you've evolved into leadership, as you've continued to get better in leadership and learn, what have been some of the influences on you? Are there any specific authors, speakers, studies that books that you've read that you've loved, anything that you'd recommend or that's resonated with you?
Yeah. Well, thanks. I was an English major, English literature major in college. Frequently my students in medical school and in residency would comment that while they learned a bit about surgery from me, they really learned how to write. I think that the opportunity to have a broad sort of liberal arts background to really reflect on the experiences of many have been incredibly helpful. As a specific example, sitting right next to me on my desk is a poem written by Wallace Stevens called 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. And while it's not something that one usually reads in their leadership training or their MBA course, it's given me the sort of opportunity to understand perspective. which is to say that it's very easy to develop, especially after years of doing this, a single way of looking at things. But what I've learned over the past through the pandemic and over the past many years is the multitude of perspectives that are helpful in arriving at the right decision in critical moments. So I guess I would my advice there is not necessarily to get out of a list of leadership books as much as it is to stay connected broadly, widely to one's workforce, but also to current trends in national and international affairs.
We'll talk about that, because writing and thinking, writing, communicating, so critical, especially as the world changes so fast, the ability to actually think and make decisions and get along with people, it becomes such important skills. You don't typically think of an English literature major as then a leading cancer specialist, physician, CEO of a health system, but it seems like it served you well.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an eclectic mix. I would certainly agree with you there. But I grew up with seven brothers and sisters. I'm sort of used to working in a field of some amount of chaos, as well as really a constant negotiation as to what are the best ways to get things moving, to move forward, to get to benefit the most. And I think that's that ability to read people, to understand people, to listen to people, and to really solve puzzles. I mean, so much of administration is solving people puzzles. That really is enjoyable, and that kind of, I think, comes from a broad based background in sort of human studies.
And in terms of the seven siblings, it's obviously not like who's the brightest, who's the nicest. How do you manage the other seven siblings, and how does that all work in a family of seven kids?
Well, this is a great conversation. I'm not exactly sure I was prepared for all this, but happy to take this on. I think I was number seven of eight. I should put that out there. I think one would have guessed I was number one of eight, but I was not. First of all, I don't think one manages one brothers and sisters, especially when you're seven of eight. You were managed. And so I think developing that humility and that understanding that you're not going to achieve any ends by sure power is an incredibly valuable lesson to learn early in life. So we actually all get along very well still. I'm fortunate that all my siblings are still alive. We actually share a family cabin together and work very well to introduce that wonderful spot to all our children. So it's been a really a gift to me, quite frankly.
What a wonderful, wonderful thing to have that broad a family and so forth. And you did a wonderful job of dodging the question of who's the brightest of the eight, which I don't blame you one bit for. I think that's the smartest thing you could do all day. What are you most excited about this year and most focused on currently?
I think that there are three things that we're really focusing on right now, and those are staffing, inpatient access, and financial health. I mean, staffing is always the top of mind. Despite the challenges that hospital systems are facing finding a full-time workforce, we've been lucky that OHSU remains a highly desirable place to work. So we have very low turnover in our nursing staff, but we've had to increase the numbers quite rapidly as we have new legislation in Oregon that assures nurses meals and breaks coverage, as well as prescribing minimal nurse patient staffing ratios. So the environment of Portland, the beautiful Northwest, and as well these really sort of beneficial conditions for our nurses and others make it easier for us to recruit and retain. I think the second thing is inpatient capacity. Oregon and Washington are the two states in the nation with the fewest hospital beds per capita. We serve both states, all of Oregon, the southwest portions of Washington. So in response to that, OHSU is expanding by 128 new beds in mid-2026. And we have room for 60 more beds once we fill our shelled areas. And then as well, we're focusing on our children's services by building a new neonatal ICU. This, of course, will increase our need for additional workforce, 8 to 1,000 clinical staff plus faculty providers to open these facilities. So we're working in parallel with the state to widen educational pathways for all types of physicians. I guess the last thing then, which we would have to call out, which of course is the thing that keeps many hospital CEOs up at night, is the ongoing financial distress of hospitals. And this was particularly true in the Northwest. It's a pivotal issue for us as expense growth in labor supplies and pharmaceuticals has vastly outpaced revenue growth for the majority of health systems. You know, commercial payers and government payers have not been able to keep up with inflation. The cost shift is therefore increasing. Health plans seem increasingly unwilling to fund the cost shift, leading to termination of commercial contracts. But all of that puts the patient in the middle in a way that's really not good for anyone, particularly our patients. It also contributes to unnecessary waste. So, you know, as a result of all of these factors, more than half the hospitals in Oregon are losing money. Their operating margins are in the red. And the decisions that are being made as a result of that are not good for people either. I think that's the other thing that's a great concern to me. OB services, behavioral health services, which rely heavily on public payers, are sort of under scrutiny at many sites. So that's kind of a bleak forecast. I could talk to you about things we're proud of if you want as well. But one of them.
I mean, it's actually. I want to ask you one more question about these issues. Then I'd love to talk to you about what you're most proud of at OHSU, which is a magnificent institution. Talk for a moment about, you know, you've been at this for some time now. I think you graduated from school around when I did, or, you know, so you've been in this for some time. You're in a specialty, numbers, 330 million people in our country versus number of physicians, shortages of specialists. How daunting does that look to you? And then I'd love to talk about what you're most proud of, because there's so much to be proud of there.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, on the macro scale, this is not a new problem. I think Uwe Reinhardt predicted this, 15 or 20 years ago, that we would have a huge gap as our population age between the need and number of physicians and other clinicians and the demand. And that, in fact, of course, is occurring and has played out really rapidly in the post-pandemic environment, where there was so much pent-up need that sort of emerged at the end of the pandemic. And we really haven't caught up with it. And the question is, will we be able to catch up with it in our lifetimes? I think it's forcing us to look at new ways of caring for people. I think certainly telemedicine has been helpful. It hasn't really solved the problem by any means. The really elevation of non-MD clinicians has been also really helpful. I think APPs are filling in much of the primary care responsibilities and doing it really wonderfully well in most settings. But I don't know that, you know, to your point, I don't know that we have a blueprint that will return us to some sort of, I'm going to use the word parity or ability to keep up in any time in the very near future.
No, it seems like a daunting problem. Talk about, take a moment, points of pride in OHSU, and, you know, you can. You know, I know it's been widely reported that you're going to retire at some point this year as CEO. So if it's fair to ask you, the personal question about some of the things you're most proud of in your career. I know you're a humble person, so I'm asking a tough question, but are there a few things that you'd point to that you take particular pride in your career, which has been a magnificent leadership career?
Yeah, well, thanks. You know, I think there, if you were to sort of divide it into both those contributions surgically and those contributions as a health administrator, I think I can just touch on a few high points of both of those. In the area of surgery, I think that my, you know, contributions have been trying to make minimally invasive surgery safer and more patient-centric. And of course, sort of, you know, created innovations in techniques. But let me just pick on both of those for just a second. You know, one of the moments that I'm most proud of was early in my days as a faculty member, when I was sitting in a meeting and some fellow turned to me and said, I hate to think about bile duct injuries associated with gallbladder surgery, but this fellow in Utah wrote a paper that has, you know, saved many patients' injuries. And that was a paper I wrote. And it was just, you know, I didn't need to say anything more except say, that's interesting. But the ability to really sort of understand how to make surgery safe and then to write about it in ways that others could read it and to help their patients has been really one of the early things that I'm proud of. And then I guess the next is just sort of taking these complex operations like an esophagectomy and creating techniques that one can do those in a minimally invasive fashion that then leads to shorter hospital stay, fewer complications, longer survival, both from the cancer and also less morbidity and mortality associated with the surgery itself. So those are sort of the surgical contributions. You know, I think as a
let me ask you for one question for a second, okay? Because you live in an area that's so interesting. I mean, it's professionally, meaning, you know, bile duct cancer, still one of these cancers that's very hard to have great success with. Pancreatic cancer, obviously now going to be one of the leading causes of death from cancer by 2030, just a huge emergence of more and more pancreatic cancer. Stomach cancer, still very daunting. And have a close colleague being treated for that at Emory of all places. But take a moment on sort of your thoughts from obviously a higher lens view, and I know you're not prepared for this question, but you live in this area. We've made great progress with colon cancer, but we're seeing younger and younger people with colon cancer too. But what's your sense of some of the improvements in some of these areas that have been very challenging cancers? Bile duct, pancreatic, stomach, any thoughts that you have on sort of what you see as the future and is it promising?
Yeah, well, thanks. And I am, you know, one of the most lethal cancers, you know, that affects the GI tract have been, you know, bile duct cancer is somewhat rare, pancreatic more common, and esophageal cancer probably also worldwide. More common than either of the other two, but in the U.S. probably a little less common than pancreatic cancer. But it's an area I know very well, an area where we have made a difference. When I started, the survival rate was 25%. Now it's over 50%. But still, we have a long way to go because it's still not 100%, still not 90%. And the key, I think, is the multidisciplinary care. As well as very early detection. Clearly, if one can detect cancer with a blood test, you have a much better chance of curing it than you can after, you know, just finding it on a CAT scan. But even without the early detection, even with more, you know, common ways that cancer is detected, which is the development of symptoms, we are making progress with the chemotherapy, with the immunotherapy. With a multidisciplinary use of surgery and radiation therapy, it's a slow progress and it's not linear. It's not the same in all types of cancer, but I think we're making some very important advances in each of the three modalities, the three main modalities that we use to approach cancer.
No, thank you. There is great progress with vaccines, immunotherapies, and so forth, and just hopefully keeps on coming and keeps on coming quicker and becomes more and more affordable. Thank you. I cut you off, and I know I promised only 10 or 12 minutes. We've now been on for 20 plus, but it's so interesting to talk to you, Dr. Hunter. If you don't mind, just a couple more minutes on things you're proud of at OHSU, and then any advice for emerging leaders. And I promise I'll keep you to a couple minutes here.
Okay. Yeah, thanks. I think I've been really proud about our ability to create a health system out of many disparate parts. And one of the things that I did early on was to bring the physician practice plan into the health system. We also integrated two community hospitals, and now we have a non-binding letter of intent to combine with Legacy Health System, which would really nearly double our ability to care for Oregonians. So we're very proud of that. That would increase our size to 32,000 employees with 100 plus locations. So it would be 3 million patient visits a year. So it would be clearly the largest employer in the Portland area, as well as the largest health system in Oregon. But I think that it's the ability to bring people together, the leadership team we've been able to create, compassionate leaders who can help bring about change while navigating the pandemic and the financial repercussions of the pandemic. Just a few examples, we launched a Connected Care Center, which is a fundamental shift in the way patients access outpatient services. We launched a health equity organization and is driving to ingrain health equity into our culture. We have had 7 hospital reaccreditation visits with DNV in early 2024 with outstanding results. We're expanding our community health services. We just opened a new FQHC on the east side of Portland, and really trying to bring our services to the community where they live.
And so, simply fantastic. And what a, it's such a play on words to say what a legacy you're leaving, but so fantastic. Congratulations. Take a moment, any advice, give us a minute on advice to emerging leaders.
Yeah, well thanks. I think I offered a bit of perspective earlier in sort of try to think broadly, think liberally, be open-minded. Talk to as many people as you can, especially the frontline staff. They often have great ideas that can help you understand an issue in a new way. Well-being for us is more than a buzzword. Our teams are working very hard on a daily basis to offer support and resources, as well as good practice models. And we've changed lots of practice models to allow people to incorporate their work into their life, with partial FTEs, split FTEs, a variety of different mechanisms. And then lastly, to be present, to around regularly, communicate regularly, encourage conversation. We have a dinner once a month, a community dinner, where we invite individuals from our community to get to know each other. You won't always make the right decision, but with input and conversation, you can best represent your organization while we are all trying to improve what we do on a daily basis.
Dr. Hunter, what a remarkable career. Thank you for your leadership. Thank you for joining us today on the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I feel like I took advantage because I had you on for 25 minutes. I promised 10 or 12, but what a great pleasure to visit with you. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Well, Mr. Becker, thank you very much. I look forward to seeing you soon, and I will continue in this space, and we'll see what happens. Thank you.